It gives me great pleasure to welcome all of you to this year's installment of the Danilo Husar Struk Memorial Lecture. 15 years ago, when Danilo died, I'm not even sure whose idea it was, but we created this annual lecture series, and it's become an institution. Of course, a lecture series, I know some of the logic that guided our thinking 15 years ago was, how much money are we going to have? So let's institute something that isn't that expensive. Right? I mean, it'd be nice to have a professorship at the university named for him too, but we weren't going to get that kind of money. But with our modest efforts, we've been now running this event for 15 years. We've had enormous success. The list of speakers, I don't remember them all anymore, so I'm going to put on my glasses and read you the names. Marco Polition was the first speaker. We had George Gorbovich, Oleg Yunitsky, Vitaly Chernetsky, Taras Koznarski, Maria Rivakovich, even I gave the talk, Miroslav Shkandrygin, Mark Andrejczyk, Tamara Hundorova, Natalia Pilipiuk, Marcos Stech, Valentina Kharkhun, last year, Mykola Sorok. A pretty good list, and as you can see by today's speaker, we're not moving down the list. we're still at the very top, although some of the people who have given this talk, of course, were deliberately chosen because they were graduate students who need a little boost in their career, so we're happy to do that for people. But I'm very proud of the fact that we've kept this institution running for 15 years, and there's no reason why we can't keep it running for another 15 or 50 years. And I hope we shall. And the reason we can do that is because we have a lot of support from particularly the family. There's no way we could have done this without Oksana Struk's fundraising and fundraising that you all contributed to. And so we're very grateful to you for that. The Canadian Foundation for Ukrainian Studies played a very prominent role and then turned the money over to CIUS, who are nominally in charge now, for better or for worse. No, I shouldn't say that, no. But as long as Ukrainian studies are well-maintained in Alberta, no, I didn't say that either, because they're in trouble in Alberta. Right? We will keep doing this. So thank you for coming. It's also a great pleasure to introduce today's speaker. Michael Naidan is perhaps best known as a translator. And boy, does he deserve to be well known as a translator. He has got to be one of the most prolific translators I've ever met. I mean, for God's sake, look, his translation has gotten him in trouble, and his surgeon is trying to fix his hand so he can keep writing.
Too much of this, yeah.
Sure. Let me just tell you, some of the translators, well, first of all, let me apologize. In the advertisement for today's event, I told you that this book would be for sale. Those of you who were here last year may remember not to trust my promises about books being available for sale at this event. Publishers go crying all the time about, no one buys their book. So I told them 2 months ago, we're holding an event, we'd be delighted to have the books here for sale. Just make sure we have the books. Can't sell books that aren't in the room. They're not in the room. They're somewhere in the mail. I have an email saying, oh yeah, we sent the books. Well, they're not here. And I apologize for that. This is a wonderful anthology. Hopefully, you will have a look either online or somewhere else that is if you click on the link on the advertisement on our webpage, it'll take you to a description of the book. This is just another example of the things Michael does. That one that he personally brought up from State College is his most recent example. Shevchenko, the essential, I think it's called, right?
Yes.
Yeah, the essential poetry of Taras Shevchenko in brand new translations. I've got a lot of experience looking at translations of Shevchenko, and it takes courage to translate Shevchenko, and I marvel at Michael's courage to take on the task of having a look at Shevchenko again. It's certainly worth it. You learn a great deal about Shevchenko, and there's a great deal worth learning about Shevchenko when you try to translate it. But for years now, Michael has been translating and winning awards. I said I'd tell you some of the things he's done. Two Colors, Selected Poetry of Mitropa Lichko, Maria Matiosis, Solotka Darusha. Some of these he is not the only translator. He's a co-translator, he's the compiler, but this is his work. Larissa Denisenko's The Saraband of Sara's Band, Irene Ruzdobutko's The Lost Button, Olha Sedakova, Freedom to Believe, Central Poetry of Bogdan Ihor Antonich, Maxim Rilsky, Viktor Neborak's The Flying Head, Yuri Andruhovich's Perversion. I'm not going to read them all. 100 Years of Youth, Bilingual Anthology, big thick volume that he compiled. He is a very productive and a very influential translator. And if it weren't for his work, many, many works of Ukrainian literature wouldn't be available, not so much to us, because most people in the room read Ukrainian anyway, but those of us who teach couldn't teach these courses without translations. In addition to that, he is, of course, a well-known scholar. But what I want to emphasize is that he has turned State College, Pennsylvania — I've been there, it's a wonderful place, and it's got a fantastic football stadium — but it's also a center for Ukrainian studies. And not that any university deserves or doesn't deserve to be a center for Ukrainian studies, but State College, Pennsylvania is a center for Ukrainian studies because Michael Najdan is there. It doesn't have 20 other Ukrainianists there. He is the George Roskov professor there. And of course, that's meaningful too. That is, he has support at Penn State because the Voskobinik Roskov family has created a financial base that he can work with. But he has used that very effectively. And if you look at all the Fulbright scholars that come to the United States, they all know the geography of Penn State very well, because that's where they go.
They all think it's in Philadelphia. I'm at the bus station in Philadelphia. Pick me up.
They may wish that it was somewhere else, but he has turned it into an important place. There's a lot that can be said about Michael Najdan. I'm not going to take up any more of his time by talking about him, but let me introduce him and his talk, Back to the Village, Folklore and Folk Beliefs in Contemporary Ukrainian Literature. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Maxim, for your very kind and generous introduction, and also for you, the audience, for coming here to listen to this wonderful series of lectures. I'm very honored to be in that group that is, I know all of them who've previously come here, and all fantastic scholars and great people. I have very close ties with University of Toronto, and it was a real pleasure for me to receive the George S.N. Lutsky Literary Award in Translation this year. It's a fantastic honor for me. I even found I was going through my office cleaning out, because we got moved to temporary offices, and I don't wish that on anybody. I have over 2,000 books in my library, and I had the largest office of anybody on campus. including the university president. And it was all just bookshelves. And then they said, well, you're going to have to share an office with one bookcase with another person, and it's about a 12 by 12 foot office. So I had to cut down my library. I've donated a lot of books to my students. I'm donating a whole bunch of books to Ukrainian library in Philadelphia. But that also forced me to reminisce and go through my old letters, and I found a lovely letter from Professor Lutsky that he wrote to me with his inimitable artistic taste, with that lovely painting by Modigliani, and with a really just very kind note when one of my first publications came out, my translations of Paolo Ticino, which is one of the most difficult things I've had to translate, that along with Perversion, Yuri Andropovich's Perversia, were the two most complex. So it was really nice for me to find this. I met Professor Lutsky once, I met Danilo Struk several times, and had really great relations with everyone here in Toronto, and with Maxim, and with Taras, and others of you I've met before, and Otis I know very well, who came to Penn State when we had a conference on Ukrainian-Russian relations. He defended the Ukrainian cause quite ably, back at a time when it wasn't particularly popular to defend the Ukrainian cause. And the Ukrainian embassy refused to send us anybody, and he was there and won the day, in my humble opinion. So I'm great. And coming in a snowstorm to State College in the end of March, which we very rarely have snow that late, but he managed to come in for that. I also have a lot of contacts with a lot of my former students have come here to Canada to do their PhD programs, and that's one of the things that allowed me to do this book. First of all, I'm very grateful to Oksana Zhelisko, who's an artist from Lviv, who did this painting. I met her briefly here at a conference at University of Toronto. I didn't see this particular painting there, but she gave me her card and said, oh, take a look at my website. And I looked at the website and I said, as soon as I saw this, I said, this is the cover of the book. And so I'm very grateful to her for allowing us to use that. And also there are a number of different translators here whom I've worked with closely. Marko Andrejczyk, who's a PhD from Toronto. And I'm just looking at the list here so I don't forget people. Helena Hrin, who did her PhD here at University of Toronto. Roman Ivashkiw, who's studied here, I guess, for a year or so and then is doing his PhD at University of Alberta. And Ulyana Pasichnik, who was very kind to give us two translations for the volume, and Olya Teterenko, who did a master's. These are all students who did master's degrees with us and then came over here to University of Toronto. And Olesha Stur, whose married name is Walla, who did a master's degree with us, got her PhD at University of Illinois and is currently teaching there. And I'm missing one of them. I'm forgetting one of them, but that's okay. I thought I would remember all of them by just looking at that. Oh, Mykola Poljucha, who was also our master's student, who did his PhD at the University of Western Ontario and got a tenure track job in Pennsylvania at a small college in Pennsylvania, not too far from us, Bloomsburg University. So we have a lot of contacts and a lot of mutual affection for all the work that you're doing here in Toronto and furthering the education of all of these really, really fantastic students. And I realize you can't do something like this on your own. You need a lot of help, and there are a lot of people who helped, and I try to thank most of them in here. And I'll pass this around so you can take a look at it. And I am sorry that there weren't copies available. It is available on Amazon and other booksellers. It's available at the Glogoslav Publishers website also. It's actually, I met with the publisher in London a couple weeks ago, and he told me it's an extremely hot seller. The two hottest sellers are Peter Fedinsky's Complete Kobzar and this. Those are the two best sellers they had. He told me he sold 700 of the Kobzars last month, which is amazing for a hardback edition. So I'll just pass that around. And I'll be talking about some of the authors in there today. And so now I'll get to the to my talk here. One thing I noticed while I was translating these various works was the emphasis on a lot of these contemporary authors were really using a lot of folklore. And I'm also grateful to one other of your Canadian scholars, Natalka Komodenko, who's the Cooley Chair of Folklore Studies at the University of Alberta. And I've known her very well for 25 or 30 years or so, when she used to work in the United States at University of Virginia. And a lot of what I know about folklore I learned through her and through osmosis in some ways, working with her. Now, folkloric elements and folk beliefs play a really significant role in a number of post-independence literary works. In perusing various texts of that time period, a variation of a common American adage may be quite true. You can take the Ukrainian writer out of the village, but you can't take the village out of the Ukrainian writer. Now, perhaps the most significant Ukrainian prose writer of all time, Nikola Hohod, also known as Nikolai Gogol, establishes a reputation as a brilliant writer with his fantastic collection of stories, Evenings on a Farmstead near Dikanka, which extensively employed exotic Ukrainian folk beliefs and folk motifs, in which he created a microcosmic fantasy world, or fantasy worlds, that enthralled his reading public of the time, and to this day, Gogol is studied as one of the greatest writers in the world. Now, Hohod's contemporary, the great Russian writer Alexander Pushkin, also focused considerably on indigenous Russian folklore, and borrowed folklore also, as a powerful tool in his creativity. He first learned his folklore through the oral tradition, and that was through his nyanya, Arina Radionovna. While Hohol's knowledge of Ukrainian folklore basically came through letters that he wrote to his mother. So in both of these writers, we see a kind of matrilineal propagation of oral culture, folklore, and myth, which is very common. That's usually passed down in a matrilinear way. And the great bard Taras Shevchenko's poetry, too, was very pregnant with Ukrainian folklore that struck a very deep chord with his reading public at the time, and you know, particularly in poems of his like The Girl Under a Spell, Prichena, and Rusalka, the water nymph. And these examples are all 19th century writers. And that's a time when all these writers lived on estates, lived in country settings, in rural settings, much closer to nature and to people who harbored these kinds of beliefs in their works. Whereas in the 20th century, there's a great shift in population to more urban settings, with cities such as Kiev, Kharkiv, and Lviv becoming cultural centers. Writers also tended to gravitate to these larger population centers, where they could reach a wider readership and take part in cultural activities. Despite that general population shift, certain Ukrainian writers, such as Vasily Stefanik, Olga Kobylyanska, Lesha Ukrainka, and Mikhail Kotsubinsky, continued the tradition of exploring Ukrainian folklore at the end of the 19th and the early part of the 20th century. And particularly Mikhail Kotsubinsky's novel, Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, is particularly a literary masterpiece that delves deeply into the Ukrainian Hutsul folklore, legends, and mysteries of the quite mysterious Carpathian Mountains. Marko Tserenik's excellent translation of Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors contains a thoroughly researched prefatory article by Bohdan Rupchak. I think it's one of the best articles that Bohdan Rupchak has ever written, entitled The Music of Satan and the Bedeviled World, as well as extensive notes that offer some of the most detailed discussion of Carpathian folklore available in English to date. Lesha Ukrainka's verse, a drama, Forest Song, Nisava Pisnya, published in 1912, comprises the primary example of a continuation of that tradition of manifestations of folklore and folk belief in poetry after the turn of the century. Now, it's been surprising to me that many contemporary Ukrainian authors, particularly women writers, even though they now live largely in urban environments, exhibit a considerable amount of familiarity with folklore and folk beliefs. Sometimes even delving deeply into them and incorporating them as an integral part of their plot designs. The mystical Carpathians and Hutzul life seem to comprise the most prominent locus of interest for these writers. There are several reasons for this. Several of the writers grew up in their formative years in these rural areas, so folklore and folk beliefs would have comprised a very integral part of their daily lives. And generally speaking, mountainous areas have been much more isolated and slower to adapt to changes in mentality and that modernization brings. So these remote rural areas have been a more fertile ground to perpetuate folk beliefs. Several writers under consideration in this presentation today additionally take on the task of retelling stories from their childhood past in the Carpathians, where those folk beliefs persist, exhibiting a certain nostalgia combined with a healthy dose of pointed irony. Now, this fascination with Ukrainian folklore among contemporary writers is not just restricted to prose writers. For example, you find a number of folk beliefs in the poetry of Petro Midyanka and Vasil Herasimyuk, who both hail from the Carpathians. While Midyanka still lives there, Herasimyuk has lived in the capital of Kiev for over two decades. Here's one example of a Herasimyuk poem from 1991, and I'll read it in English translation. I have a Ukrainian if you'd like to look at that later. And this is my own translation. Is your fortune in the stars? I tell fortunes by the stars. A Christmas star led shepherds and woodcarvers. I know the ancient art of woodcarving, though I can no longer carve that way. I told my own fortune. You must get up before sunrise, washing your face with the water of life. Bury a tiny box in a hillock. In it will be your hair and the salt of your body, taken by you from your son. Be sure never to mention this again. Now, this water of life is a very typical folktale motif, and the ritual of burying hair is common to guard against evil, against witches and sorcerers from using elements of a living human being to cast spells. In typical fashion, in this poem, the folk beliefs coexist with the Christian belief in the foretelling of the birth of Jesus. In one of Midyanka's poems, For Some Reason You're Wandering in the Beech Forest, the poet fuses the biblical creation myth with indigenous pagan belief. In his words, when you read, man is made of clay, and a devil breathes life into him, you choose a wooded dale, a footpath, and the forest. The lines echo the Hutzul creation myth of the Aridnik, who, according to the description found in Kotsubinsky's words in his novella, the devil rules everything in the world and is linked to God with the status of a co-creator. Now, even Oksana Zabushko, whose literary output is largely urban-focused, at times includes prominent elements of Ukrainian folklore in her poetry. In one of her best poems on the creative process, A Definition of Poetry, Vyznachenie Poezii, she writes, and again I'll just quote my English translation of this, thank you, Lord, for giving us a body. When I die, tell the roofers to take down the rafters and ceiling. They say my great-grandfather, a sorcerer, died this way. When my body softens with moisture, pouring out as though through a boiled egg white, the bloated soul, dark and bulging, will strain like a blue vein in the boiled egg white, and the body will ripple with spasms, like the hot blanket wrestled off by a sick man, and the soul will rise to break through the press of flesh, the curse of gravity. Now, Zabushko herself, in a conversation with me, when I was translating that particular poem in the early 90s, indicated to me that her great-grandfather was a sorcerer, a vidmak, and upon his death was removed from the house, not through the door, but through the roof. And that was so that the soul would be released and leave the earthly realm without haunting the living behind. Zabushko at that time also personally told me that she had the what she called the znak vidme, the sign of the witch. Now, I realize some people consider her one, but she actually admitted to me that she had the znak vidme back then, the sign of the sorceress, which, according to her, was a prematurely gray spot on the back of her hair, a circular spot. And I remember her once calling me over and saying, look, take a look, this is my znak vidme. And she showed me that spot on the back of her head. Now, curiously, when she was questioned about that later, I told this story to a reporter, and the reporter had an interview with Oksana and asked her about this, and she said, "Oh no, Naidan is lying. I never said anything like that." So you can either take her word or take my word for it. But although I do remember it quite vividly. And I didn't ask if her grandfather, sorcerer, had been a Navcheni, a trained Vidmak, or a Prerogeni, a naturally born one. Now, the born sorcerer would have been bald with grotesque physical features. So I'd like to take a picture of her great-grandfather to check that out, to see if he's a trained one or a naturally born one. So the word, the root for the word Vidmak itself, as well as the feminine form Vidma, itself comes from the Slavic root meaning knowledge. The Ukrainian Vidmaki were bearers of secret knowledge, with the power to do good, healing people, or evil, casting spells on people or drying up milk and cows through their practice of magic. Now, two contemporary women prose writers from different generations have a considerable amount of folklore material in their works, Tanya Malarchuk and Maria Matios, who both grew up in the Carpathians. The Matios book, which I've translated with Olya Titarenko, who's sitting here in the audience, and she also co-translated Rozdobutko's novel Gudzik with me that came out with Vladislav. Currently, Andrei Kurkov is trying to place the book with one of his English publishers from England. And there's a film being made of Solotka Darusha. I just sent the filmmaker, whose name I think is Denisenko, if I'm not mistaken, who was doing the film, and they're using our translation to do the subtitles for the film, which is going to have its premiere in Paris and London. And I'm not sure the exact date that that's going to happen. So both of those writers grew up in the Carpathians, and there's a third writer that I'm not going to talk a lot about today, Halina Pahuchak, from the outskirts of Lviv, who also used a tremendous amount of folklore and material in her fantasy works. Particularly her novel, The Minion, I translated it as The Minion from Sluha z Dobromilja, in which the hero is the offspring of a vampire and a witch. Vampires and witches, in Pahuchak's view, have been mistakenly associated with evil. Thus her narrative, which fuses Ukrainian historical reality with fantasy, serves as a sort of historical corrective to create her alternative perception of their place in the world as creatures helpful to humankind and not ones that do harm. Pahuchak considers herself to be a witch. So many of Yuri Vinichuk's and Valery Shevchuk's prose works also focus on folk beliefs and folklore, particularly take note of Vinichuk's Malvalanda, which came out in 2000, and Shevchuk's novella, The Hunchback Zoya, Horbunka Zoya, and also his novel, Dimna Hori, earlier novel, 1983. Now, Malyarchuk, who moved first to Kiev to work as a journalist and currently resides in Vienna, focuses entirely on her native Carpathian mountains in her memoristic first-person narrative, From Above Looking Down, A Book of Fears, which came out in 2006. Now note the conversation of the authorial I with her aunt Mitya at the end of the second chapter of the book. And this is in my translation, which this part of it does appear in the Her Stories volume. "I feel like Aunt Mitya is happy for me because she stopped being the end of the village. I have now become the end of it. Aunt Mitya's happy not to be the last on the list. Her cow gives really fatty milk. You know what to do so as the milk doesn't go sour? What? Put it in a bucket of cold water, and if it doesn't go foul, it's best to throw a frog into the milk. I'm turning foul. Why'd it turn foul if a frog's the same as milk? It's all the same nature. Maybe if you wash the frog well, it doesn't bite? A frog? I heard there's frogs that bite. Who told you that? Where could you hear something like that? It's all a lie. Frogs don't bite, just if some witch puts a spell on one. I need to go because it's going to get dark soon, and the mountains, it gets dark really quickly. Goodbye, I say to Aunt Mitya. Thanks so much for the milk. You're so good to me. Sweetie, then who's help you if not for me? Since we's here all alone, we need to help each other. and we's here alone, just us and God above us. And it's really close to God from here. And again, it's this fusion of religious belief with these folkloric beliefs that, you know, come into play with one another in many of these works. Now, frogs generally have a dual nature in Ukrainian folk belief. On the one hand, as found in this passage, because they live in one of the four primary elements, water, they are used for their healing properties and often for the purification of well water. On the other hand, they also can be traditionally associated with evil and elements of the underworld, with an ability to transmute themselves into other forms. So these kinds of folk beliefs inhabit the same cultural and ideational space as religious beliefs. They are in the Carpathian Mountains, where Aunt Mitya resides, close to God. Mountains, of course, are symbolic places where humans can ascend to obtain mysteries from God, physically closer to the heavens where God or the gods dwell. Note Moses ascending Mount Sinai to receive the Ten Commandments from God, the Temple of the Mount where Christ reveals the Word of God to the masses, Mount Olympus where the Greek gods dwell. Now, mountains tend to have a sacred aura in virtually all cultures of the world. The Carpathians have that aura for Ukrainian culture, as well as bald mountains that are associated with witches' sabbaths and the occult. Actually, my last time in Lviv, I actually saw a witches' sabbath at the Bald Mountain next to Vysoky Zamok. They gather there fairly often and have witches' sabbaths. And you see them doing ring dances. I happened to catch them doing that one time. Now, folk beliefs are at the core of Malyarchuk's story, short story, A Village and Its Witches. It's actually one of my favorites. In that volume, I have a couple of favorite works. That's one of them, Malyarchuk's A Village and Its Witches. In its profound simplicity, it's just a beautiful story. And I also made some discoveries in doing that volume. One of the big discoveries I made was a fantastic story by Sofia Majdanska, the girl who drew on sand, or the girl who painted on sand, which is a beautiful lyrical piece that virtually nobody in Ukraine knows. Alla Perminova did half of the translation for this volume, and I'm going to convince her to do the other half, to do the entire story. It is just, if you don't read anything else in the volume, read that story. It is just really astounding, astounding story. It's about a little girl who paints, you know, draws in the sand to send messages to her father, who has left the family. But she thinks her father has gone overseas and is going to come back and sweep her away and take her back. And he's actually left the family and is not coming back. But it's that the pictures that she creates on the sand and in her mind in a beautiful lyrical way. It's just a lovely piece. So in the first line of Malyarchuk's story, she matter-of-factly writes, "My dad was born in the village where witches and wasted people live." And just as matter-of-factly later adds, "The majority of the witches worked at the bakery. One of them even happened to be a distant aunt of mine. It was her aunt, Katerina Kaska." Note the Kaska is her name, and Kaska, you know, the fairy tale, "who had a penchant for thrashing the narrator's father and sisters when they were young. Kaska operates in mysterious ways in the village, which is appealing to Malyarchuk's narrator, who admires her and seems to want to become privy to her secrets. When either the narrator or her father surreptitiously follow the witch's movements and accidentally catch her wicked gaze in return, they would fall on the floor paralyzed for half an hour as a result of the evil eye. The father warns his daughter to be careful because this isn't a village," Dad said, "but a witch's spawn." Malyarchuk's narrator befriends Kaska's pale, sickly daughter, Lyubka, and plays with her every day in the summer outdoors, competing for the little girl's attention to the bane of her mother, the witch, who also cares for her deeply. A telling conversation between the narrator and her father gives the explanation for the little girl's illness that is ingrained in the village's system of folk belief in family curses. "Right about that time, for the first time, I said to my dad that there is no great evil, just a lot of little ones. My dad answered that I'm stupid. But look how good Kaska is with Lyubka, how she cares for her and how she loves her. Is that evil you're talking about capable of love? Kaska's taking care of Lyubka because she feels guilty." Why do you think Lubka has leukemia? Descendants pay for the actions of an evil person. And the story ends with the little girl Lubka dying, and I'm quoting, "Like a little bird, a teeny tiny bird, she disintegrated into crystal bits, poured out like milk, dissolved in the air, flew away." Her death, as described by Mollerich, implies magical transformation into spirit, a characteristic of witches and other magical creatures. Soon after that, the narrator sees Casca carrying water from the well and screams out at her through the window, "Witch!" Casca looked into my eyes quite intently with all the hate that could fit in such a not very big world and answered back, "So what?" Beautiful ending to the story, which sets it up in a very wonderful way. The witchery in the story clearly comprises a natural order of life in the village and in the consciousness of the adult narrator looking back at her childhood. The folk belief in an ancestral curse for one's family members' past transgressions is quite common in Ukrainian folk belief, and it's particularly prominent in literary sources such as Hoho's Stories of Terrible Vengeance, as well as in the more recent novels like Matyos's Sweet Darusha, where that motif occurs, and actually what happens to Sweet Darusha may be part of that ancestral curse, if you read it that way, because of her mother and father and things that happened with her mother hanging herself. So the next author I wanted to deal with today is Maria Matyos, and her prose works are really deeply imbued with local folklore and folk beliefs with which she grew up in her native Bukovina. Her novel, Sweet Darusha, contains a compendium of characters for whom these beliefs share equal weight with religious beliefs and are essential part of the fabric of daily life. Darusha, the novel's protagonist, is quite similar to an archetypal folk figure, a yuradibi, a god's fool, who seemingly lives on the fringes of normal society, yet whose strangeness and idiosyncrasies alienate others. In the first part of the novel, Darusha's father gives her a swat on the behind with a birch switch for questioning a local yuradivi's eccentric behavior. "Why did you beat me, father?" Darusha asked that evening after her eyes had dried from the tears and her bottom had stopped burning. "Everyone says that Parashka's foolish, but Slavko and I didn't say it. We just gave the sign that she's weak in the head. Weak in the head, but they're God's people. That's all father said then." "And what about us? Aren't we all God's people?" Darusha asked in disappointment. "Mama sometimes is also weak in the head. But you, father, have never said that Mama is one of God's people." It may have been the first time father patted Darusha on her head. "Darusha, sometimes our Mama's head hurts because she fell down from the top of the dam. But she's not weak in the head. But Parashka's not all there. And that's why she's one of God's people, because only she can speak freely with God. But the rest of us aren't like Parashka. And may God grant that you, my sweet little child, never be the same kind of God's person as Parashka. So you, father, wouldn't want your Darusha to speak with God?" "My sweet wonder," father kissed Darusha on her brow. "Say an Our Father and go to sleep. That's the best conversation you can have with God." Darusha, ironically, after her father is executed, does become a Yuradivi figure who speaks only to her father at his grave, but remains mute to the rest of the world. In Darusha's adult life, her method of self-healing parallels a folk motif found in the Ilya of Murom tales. The Bohater Ilya gains strength when his feet touch his native soil and loses strength when detached from it. He also uses the water of life to cure his paralysis so that he can become a Bohater. Darusha finds relief for her massive headaches by digging a hole and burying herself up to her waist in the earth, a sacred element, and also by another sacred element, water, which serves to relieve her ailments when she stands in the cold water of the river Cheremosh. Matyos describes Darusha's healing ritual as follows. She sometimes even digs a hole in the middle of the garden to the height of her lower back. She lowers herself into it, wraps herself in the living black cover that tickles her body with broken roots, worms, and rotted leaves, and she stands or sits in the living earth this way for hours. The earth takes away her pain and gives her the sap of life. It rises up along her body to her brow. as if along a tree trunk. And inside herself, Darusha again feels strength that had been taken from her head by the red-hot iron of pain when it seemingly crawls out even through her ears and skin. So the novel's narrator also describes another instance of someone in the village, a village boy, Tarasik, who was struck by lightning, and he's brought back to life by burying him up to his neck in the earth. So contact with living Mother Earth restores him. And Darusha also relieves her pain by taking her shoes off and walking barefoot by direct contact with the earth, the believed origin of life. I had a very interesting tour of a museum in Kiev 3 or 4 years ago and he was showing us different aspects of Ukrainian village houses. And one of the things that really remained with me was that a lot of the village houses had earthen floors. And it wasn't because they couldn't afford to put in a floor. It was because of their belief that contact with Mother Earth had healing properties and beneficial properties, and was a very positive thing to have that kind of floor. And he also said, and I don't know how true it is, that something like 97% of the elements in the clay are the same as in the human being. And I don't know if that's kind of a folk notion of God making Adam out of clay, or that's true or not, but that's what his folk belief was at the time. Now, among other folk beliefs, the inhabitants of the village of Cheremoshne believe in unclean spirits, Rusalke and Yavke, those are river nymphs, the spirits of unbaptized girls or girls who suffered a violent death, who then seduce young men to their deaths. The blud, a type of unclean spirit in Carpathian folklore, that when touched by someone leads that person to get lost and into danger. I'm actually very grateful to Olya Fitarenko for doing some research for me on the blud and enlightening me about that. One thing that I have noticed is, this really needs to be done, there really is very little in English other than Bohdan Rubchak's introduction to on Ukrainian folklore and folk beliefs. There are some wonderful volumes. One of them we have in our library at Penn State, which is, and I forget what the bishop's name was, but it was an Orthodox bishop who published a book of Ukrainian folk beliefs about 50 years ago that has never been translated into English. And there are some lovely recent editions. There's a three-volume edition that came out in Western Ukraine of Ukrainian folklore and folk beliefs. And there's a lot of very interesting stuff out there. And for comparative studies, it's really important. So if you have any students, enterprising students who want to do a project, I think there are several that are very important. I actually asked Natalka Komamenko if she would be interested in doing something like this, or one of her students. And she said to me, she's too busy collecting Canadian folklore to really work on this now. So it's and she wanted to do that to show her gratefulness to the Kule family for funding and for funding her professorship there. There are also, besides the blud, there is the Szczesnik Vanisher, a demonic mischievous creature associated with the devil, who is invisible and appears and disappears. There's also belief in family curses passed on through generations for individual transgressions. In the novel, a woman's family is cursed for the fact that she stole an embroidered blouse from a recently deceased person's house. Embroidered rushniki, of course, are protection from evil in baptismal, in marriage, and funeral rituals. People in the Carpathians believe in healing with herbs, with smoke, with water. Religious rituals for the villagers of Cheremoshne, too, such as crossing themselves, greeting people by saying Slava Isu, you know, glory be to Jesus, or saying the Our Father prayer, for them largely comprise magical incantations against evil. Even some of the names of the characters in the novel, such as the NKVD agent Gidushenko, who interrogates Darusha's father, suggests demonic agency. Gidko, of course, is a common name for the devil in Ukraine. Now, one of the more humorous instances of folk healing in the novel occurs when Darusha's neighbor Maria rushes in distress to a neighbor's house on Easter to say that her drunkard son Slavko is dying. Nikola the forester, without getting up from the Easter table, responds to her, "Maria, piss into his mouth." He'll get better right away. If you don't have any piss, dilute some horse dung with water and pour some of it into his mouth. Maria obliges by lifting up her skirt and urinating into his son's orifice, her son's orifice, while her husband and another man hold him down on the ground. This, of course, ends up reviving and saving him. It's a somewhat different libation than the one that, if you know the Irish song Finnegan's Wake, the crather, the homebrew, spilling on Finnegan ends up reviving him from his wake. So, it's quite clear that these folk beliefs and folk superstitions really abound in the novel as an integral part of Matthias's microcosmic world of Chedimochne. Now, one writer whom I've translated with Olya, Irene Rozdobuto, is one that you wouldn't expect to have these kind of folk beliefs in her background, because she was born in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. She was Russian-speaking until she married the poet Remoruk. Ihor Remoruk, and then now has become one of Ukraine's most popular writers in Ukrainian. Some people don't take her writing seriously because she is so popular, and she does write what we might call in the West chick novels. So this Budzik, which I translated as The Lost Button, is somewhat of a chick novel, but it's a really deep psychological novel, and I think really deserves a lot more respect from literary critics. Now, in that novel, The Lost Button, a trip to the Carpathian a Carpathian resort initiates events in the novel, when there's a young man by the name of Denis who meets a mysterious older woman, Liza Tenetska, on a dark night for a walk at a mountain resort. He first sees her as a light flickering in the darkness, and then as something of a ghostly spirit, and I'm quoting from the novel in translation, a silhouette etched by the light of the moon, resembling an incorporeal, empty outline in the total darkness. What he's actually seeing is her cigarette. She's smoking a cigarette, and he sees the light, but this really mimics the blood. So she's similar to the blood, the Carpathian spirit that leads people astray to their doom when you touch them. She's dressed in a long black shawl, and in a rite of seduction initiation, leads him by the hand deep into the dark forest, where his passion for her grows exponentially. 5 days later, the young Dennis wheedles his way into participation in an already filled group for a planned hike with her, along with 12 others at the resort. When she and Liza fall behind the rest of the group on the hike, Liza says to him, "Let them go to the devil, doditka." After getting lost as night falls, they decide to make a campfire and spend the night in the woods, drinking some homemade blackberry wine he had brought from an older woman standing outside the Silpo general store at the resort. The wine functions as a magic potion for the two as they drink it. In the morning, Liza says to Dennis, "Run, get the bottle, we'll warm it up. Don't worry." In the morning, wine loses its magic. He crawls into the bushes to seek out the magical libation. And after continuing to wander for half a day, a sudden thunderstorm catches them. They find refuge in a hayloft in a barn to spend the night. And despite Lisa's warnings to him about ruining his life by a liaison with her, he makes love to her anyway. That carnal evening of pleasure, a figurative and literal romp in the hay, turns into an obsessive love for Dennis, who in short time learns that his mysterious love is his instructor in a class he signs up for at the university. When he approaches her after the first class of the semester with her, she makes it quite clear she wants to cut off sexual relations with him. Powerfully bewitched by Liza, he falls into utter despair. He ends up volunteering to go to the Afghan War to try to forget her, and eventually returns to a career becoming a very well-known writer and teacher of script writing. Many years later, Dennis, as a mature and distinguished professor, has a vivacious young artist named Lika fall in love with him. After a whirlwind romance, a very quick romance, they marry. In the irony of ironies, his young wife turns out to be the daughter of his former love, Liza, whom he realizes he still loves after being reintroduced by Lika to her. In a second irony, Lika, while hiding in an antique wardrobe she is about to present to her husband, Dennis, as a gift before she leaves for an artist exhibition in the Carpathians, overhears Dennis, her husband, confess his love for her mother, Lisa, who rejects him outright for a second time. Devastated by what she surreptitiously overheard, Lika leaves on her trip to the artist Biennale, where she undergoes transformation, losing the memory of her previous life by rituals that can easily be described as magical. When Dennis meets Lika, he refers to her as his frog princess, with a face like the Virgin Mary and skin like Chinese porcelain. Frogs, of course, as I mentioned, are emblems of transformation and resurrection for their life cycle, you know, that moves from egg to tadpole to frog. And at the Biennale in the Carpathians, Lika's existence begins to resemble that of a mechanical doll named Suok from Yuri Alyosha's fairy tale, Three Fat Men. Suok also happens to be the name of Dennis's favorite restaurant near his place of work, as well as the name of a girl who takes the place of a mechanical doll for a boy in Alyosha's fairy tale. Lika, now with the new nickname of Fox, note the link to the animal world, mechanically submits to artist friend Vika's suggestion to alter her appearance by giving her dreadlocks, with just her head twitching in all directions like a doll. The next morning, the girl arrives. The girl who arrived yesterday noticeably stood out from the crowd. She was beyond recognition. Ethnic braids, dreads stuck out in every direction around her face. So she goes in ritual transformation. She undergoes this ritual transformation from human to animal to inanimate doll. And she's reborn out of the inanimate doll eventually. A few days before the end of the Biennale, Lisa slips out of the camp at night to escape toward a mountain into the forest. And I'm quoting from the novel here. I headed toward the mountain, and the further I went away from the camp, the clearer it was to me. That's exactly what I needed. I happened to be where I was supposed to be. I discerned the sense like an animal and was able to see in the total darkness. It seems to me I was even running on all fours, running all night long, until the scent of the camp town stopped tormenting me. I sank my hands into the earth on steep hills and felt that it was alive and floating. I walked until pink ribbons of the morning began to flutter over the tops of fir trees. They expanded, unfolded, and fell over the mountains and forests in wide veils. I wanted to drink, so I bent over a spring. I saw an entire small underwater town at the bottom. Eggs laid by dragonflies, and also leeches and snails. Then I piled leaves onto myself and slept till the next morning. And at night, I sallied forth again. Again, that contact with Mother Earth and elements of Earth helps to re-energize her. So she inadvertently, or perhaps it was foreordained, she ends up at the same place in the Carpathians where her mother, Lisa, first had met her husband, Dennis. There she meets an old woman who takes pity on her and gives her an egg to eat, which she gobbles up like an animal. The woman, a kindly white magic witch, Vidma figure, who lives alone, allows Lika to earn her keep by working around the house for food and lodging. On the next day, Lika works in the orchard, which is much like a skater samobranka, a magic tablecloth that provides food at will, a mini paradise brimming with ripe fruit. And I'm quoting from the novel again here, I've never seen such fruit before. Tree branches bent to the ground under the weight of huge apples. The fruit was with fat cheeks that looked like the heads of chubby cherubs. The old woman brought a whole pile of woven baskets and placed them under the trees. Now I understood why she said, take off the apples. They were so juicy that you had to take them carefully because the juice would gush out under the slightest touch. And the plums also were just as ripe as she takes them off. Now, several days later, Lika begins to cut off her hair with a pair of scissors she finds in the house. The elderly woman finishes the ritual Lika had begun by shaving her bald with sheep shears her son had given her. The woman then takes the shorn locks out into the garden where she buries them to keep them from being used in magical rituals against Lika. Later that day, after sundown, the elderly woman takes her to a friend of hers, Yakivna, the bathhouse manager, who heats up water to bathe Lika and clean her clothes. Yakivna then treats Lika to a sumptuous dinner with her homemade blackberry wine, and it's the same quote-unquote magical wine that Dennis had bought so many years earlier Kramer next to the Sealed Post store in the Carpathian Resort. The ritual cleansing is a form of baptism for a new self and a springboard for a new life. And that wine, and the wine, a magic potion to purify her and to allow her to forget her past and heal her heart. The narrator notes that the wine was black and thick, like honey or blood. So the rejuvenated Nika describes drinking it as follows. And what wine it was. The first drop was like blistering viscid resin. Sweet and thick lava flowed down my throat. Its stream ran further, washing off all my insides. It was as if I saw myself from inside, felt my every cell, just like I did in the morning, and I lost feeling in my legs. It was as if a butterfly swallowtail was trying to open its glued wings inside my chest. The thick liquid had the taste of time, the bitterness of 20-year-old dust ingrained into the glass of the bottle, the roughness of the wild berries that died long ago, and the sweetness of yellow sugar, a kind that no longer can be found, and also a particular aroma of some kind of unknown potion. My lips nestled eagerly on the mug, and I tore myself away only when they had turned black and when whiteness glimmered on the bottom. So she describes her ritual transformation after she imbibes the magic potion as follows. My head was humming and splitting until a hot flood of tears finally burst through. I was crying and laughing at the same time. It felt better with every moment, as if I were driving snakes, lizards, black mice, and slithery rats out of myself. That was the impression I had. And this, of course, is driving that evil out of her. Which may be the nature that she inherits from her mother as a blood, or possibly part of the family curse caused by her mother's transgressions. With their white kerchiefs, the two old women appeared to Nika as if they had lived there in the Carpathians 100 years or more, with their seeming longevity suggesting their supernatural nature. When the old women ask her to reveal her name, she utters Angelika, so the combination of Angel with her name Nika. She then observes, I didn't recognize my voice, as well as that name that had to become mine from then on. It was strange to me. It belonged to somebody else. It was fake, like a Hollywood beauty's breasts. So the ritually reborn Angelika eventually leaves the protective circle of the two witches, Hana Parasivna and Yakivna, and enters a new life in another land. She ends up in San Francisco in the United States. Her husband, Dennis, in his former life, loses his former life and is no longer under the spell of Nika's mother, Lisa. He ends up spending the rest of his life in despair trying to find Nika, who he realizes is his true love. And unknown to Nika, Angelika, her mother, having lost her daughter, goes insane and placed in an asylum. So there's only one character in the entire story who ends up living happily ever after, and that's Lisa's husband, who's a former political prisoner. And so he ends up happy because he just divorces her and he marries a new wife. And everybody else either goes crazy or insane. So this is, in my opinion, is an inverted fairy tale with virtually no happy endings except the one happy ending of the husband, who of course, because he suffered being a political prisoner, he deserves a good fate in the end. So all the characters in the novel who seek happiness and love fail to find it or fail to recognize it. And even Lika, Angelika, only finds oblivion, the loss of memory of her previous life, and a newly protected tabula rasa life following her complete ritual transformation in the mysterious Carpathians. So these are just some examples I've noticed. There are a lot more that you can find, particularly some people have worked on Valery Shevchuk, and there's plenty of this kind of stuff in Shevchuk's writings. I remember reading at least one article on that and I forget who wrote it, it is amazing to me that there is so much of this this kind of material that is still really an integral part of Ukrainian life, of these authors who are not, some of them are not growing up in the village anymore, but really gravitate towards these beliefs. And that's all I had to say today. If you have any questions, I would be happy, or comments, I would be happy to answer them, or try to answer them at least.